I wanted to ask in that connection, the council repeatedly passed condemnatory resolutions, especially in the earlier years. And one of the threats that Kaius made to the Iraqis was that he was going to take this to the council.
Was Iraq responsive to these threats from the council, and if so, why?
Well, they were. That was an important tool, and the Kaius was extremely attentive to keeping the council together, and rightly so. You know, when we were in Baghdad, there were some unique features of the way UNSCOM was organized. We were a sub-organ of the council. To the extent that the council supported us, that was our only authority in Iraq. Mm-hmm. You know, you're there all by yourself, and you know who you going to call? It was only the council. So to the extent that the council was united and strong, we had leverage. As I said earlier, there's a natural inclination, a natural progress where that, a unitary actor can't outlast a coalition, because as time goes on, people have other issues and agendas and so on and so forth. The Kaius spent a lot of time trying to keep the glue of the council, you know, from dissolving, and I think he kept it together longer than many other people would have. But we did use that tool. There was a language which was key in many of these statements by the council called material breach. And this became a code word for the impending use of force, because if the council said that Iraq was in material breach of its obligations under Resolution 687, that lifted the responsibility of the other party in this contract, but you could think of it that way, I suppose. It lifted their obligations, and the obligation was a ceasefire. The ceasefire resolution wasn't a treaty or a peace and so forth. And so if Iraq was found in material breach of the resolution, then that lifted the ceasefire obligation on the part of the coalition. And it was thought that force could come afterwards. Now, that language occurred probably in council statements or on the order of 6 or 7 times. Force may have been used 2 or 3 times. And over time, these statements by the council lost their impact. To the point where I think ultimately in 97 and later they, you know, the Iraqis treat these as like parking tickets in New York City. There was an inflection point in my view on this in the summer of 96, and here's a point where I would disagree with Rolf Kaius in our judgments on this, and this has to do with the June period, where we had some blockages over some intrusive inspections, and Kaius was asked by the council to go out to Baghdad, and he came back with a joint statement, a joint program of action, and modalities for inspection of sensitive sites.
Right.
And my judgment on this may be colored by perhaps a deeper view into what was going on in the United States and Washington in the lead up to these things and then the crisis surrounding it. And I'll give you my take on it. We had had an inspection called 150, which was headed by Chief Inspector Nikita Smirnovich. And this was the second in our series of dedicated concealment mechanism inspections. we had had an earlier one called Inspection 143 in March of 1996, also headed by Nikita Simonovich. And we had learned from that, and we had learned from the other materials we had collected, that security organizations, key ones in Iraq, had been involved in the movement of what would be described materials. Some of these locations were around the Saddam International Airport, which borders on presidential areas. It's an area which is sensitive to the Iraqis, and we attempted to inspect some of these areas. There were blockages. In particular, we had standoffs at, I believe there were three locations, Special Republican Guard sites and Special Security Organization sites, which went on for long periods of time. Rolf went into the council to brief on these. There were standoffs, and ultimately the Iraqis did not relay. We withdrew our team, and this was a big issue with the council. They issued a resolution, I forget the exact number, might have been 1060. But a resolution condemning the Iraqis, they had presidential statements condemning the Iraqis. We had a lot of problems. They were forcing helicopters out of the area, helicopters which we have every right to observe, and we were trying to observe inside the locations which were blocked, and the Iraqis were forcing the helicopters away. They were manning anti-aircraft sites, pointing weapons at the helicopters. It was a difficult, difficult time. The council... this is reflecting my sort of window into what Washington was doing. Washington was spending a lot of time in capitals and in New York bringing together a consensus that, look, if the Iraqis don't agree to this, we're going to thump them, and we want your support, and we're going to thump them seriously. As part of that diplomatic activity, it was agreed with the council, says, okay, we're going to give the Iraqis one more chance. We'll send a case back out to Baghdad with instructions. Look, they've got to agree to provide immediate, unconditional, unrestricted access. Rolf went out and had discussions with Tariq Aziz. I wasn't present. And came back with these three documents, one of which was a joint statement signed by himself and Tariq Aziz, which said that the Iraqis would provide immediate, unconditional, and restricted access. The second document, which was agreed but not signed, was a joint program of action, which was a series of things that the Iraqis and UNSCOM would work on to move the process forward. The third document, which initially was going to be kept confidential in a sense, but certainly not provided to the Security Council, was a list of procedures that Ikeas would instruct his inspectors to follow if Iraq declared any given site to be sensitive. The so-called sensitive site modalities. This was in fact discussed and negotiated with Tariq Aziz in the drafts that went back and forth. But it was a unilateral instruction by a case to his inspectors. And there were various aspects of this, but if Iraq declared a site sensitive, there was a limited number of inspectors who could go in. There was not a limit on the amount of time they could spend there, but there were a lot of
it provided for more advanced notice, didn't it?
It provided for a period of time where access would not be permitted while Iraq brought a senior official to the site. So in essence, we didn't need a pre-notify that we're going to a sensitive site, but there was a built-in period of time when UNSCOM could provide perimeter security, in a sense, perimeter observation, but we couldn't go in until a senior Iraqi arrived on the scene. Now, in the Baghdad area, that was understood to be about an hour and a half. If you were up near Tikrit, someplace distant from Baghdad, it would be longer. This could be seen as a set of, you know, where access was neither unrestricted nor immediate nor unconditional. So on the one hand you have a signed statement which says one thing, on the other hand you have a procedure which in which you're in a fairly formal way giving up those rights. The chaos came back to New York. The Iraqis had leaked to the Russians and others in Baghdad immediately this piece of paper. And so between the time the chaos got to Bahrain, this was coming out, and it was an awkward circumstance. In my view, that undermined, that was the last time there was going to be a consensus on use of force against Iraq to enforce this. And I think, to me, it was an inflection point. Now, Iraq would argue, I think, strongly the other way on this. But I think from the Iraqis then saw that there were definitely going to be limits on what the council would permit. I think as a matter of practice, the modalities did not allow the full type of inspections that we needed. I mean, they didn't work, and I think in practice that was it. Rolf would argue and said, but look, that's the best. We live in a political world. This is the best we're going to get. It's better to have something than nothing. And you know, there's certainly a lot of, he's got a lot of points on his side on this. But I think in terms of what the council was able to agree on, and I think from my perspective, seeing that the work that the National Security Council, the White House, and others had done to try to build a consensus on, you know, really holding Iraq's feet to the fire, they pulled them. These set of documents pulled the rug out from under that, and that's you know, I think that was a problem. Ultimately, I don't know if it would have made any difference to the final outcome. But that was what happened.
Let me ask a related question. Somewhat later, when the Secretary General Kofi Annan went to Baghdad and reached an agreement with the Iraqis, as he was leaving, Tariq Aziz handed him a letter or a piece of paper of some kind. I think that Kofi Annan position that piece of paper was not important in terms of the agreement he had reached. It was something intended for UNSCOM. How did UNSCOM interpret this?
I think what you're referring to is not a piece of paper, which Tariq Aziz handed the Secretary, but a letter which was sent. So when he received, like, the day he got back.
I thought he actually handed it to him at the airport, but maybe not.
I wasn't there. But I know there was a letter which arrived.
It's the letter. It's the letter.
And appeared to be modifying the agreement which the Secretary General had just, you know, this triumph, which, I say that facetiously, the Secretary General said, look, I've come to my agreement, this doesn't bear, and quickly tried to bury this thing, and informed the Iraqis that they should, you know, forget they had sent this letter. But, I mean, you know, to the cynics of UNSCOM, this was no surprise to us that the Iraqis would be trying to weasel out of this as quickly as possible. My personal view of that whole episode was pretty negative.
Yeah, could you elaborate on that? What was your perception of this episode of Kofi Annan's effort?
Well, one of the Iraqi objectives was to get around on Islam. So long as the council said UNSCOM is our actor in this, and you, Iraq, are not going to come to us except via UNSCOM, we have a lot of authority. But as Iraq became more and more successful in going around UNSCOM, going directly to council members and looking for second judgments, other judgments, that was, you know, they were making progress on that. They had sought for quite some time to involve the Secretary General as a way of, again, getting around UNSCOM. UNSCOM and Iraq were not equal parties in the process initially set up in 1991. UNSCOM was superior to Iraq. What Iraq was successful in doing over time was maneuvering themselves in a position where Iraq and UNSCOM were equal parties at the bar being the Security Council or perhaps the Secretary General. And that was something that they were successful at. The council ultimately allowed them to do that. The Secretary General allowed them to do that. Whether that was, whether we contributed to that by steps that we had taken, the various chairmen or, you know, whatever, it was a fact that the dynamic was changing. And when the Secretary General agreed to step into this issue, that confirmed it. The previous Secretary General, which was Ghali, wouldn't touch Iraq with a 10-foot pole. That was a council issue. He would go nowhere near it. That was to our benefit, frankly. But Kofi Annan, for whatever reasons, decided that this was an issue that, you know, he had an obligation to participate in. He had very little background in this. I think a matter of days of study of the issue, the primary issue at the time was this debate over access to presidential sites, and this, the fundamental issue was muddied by all parties, and not the United States did a lot of damage itself in this because they were trying to build a momentum for possible military force. They wanted to build a public case for this, and so they made all kinds of ludicrous presentations to the press about, well, there could be, you know, 5 pounds of anthrax in one of these presidential palaces that could kill a squillion people. Absurd presentations which muddied the real principal issue that UNSCOM was faced with, and that was we could not accept and perform the task given to us, a shift in our right of access, whether it be a presidential area or some other area. It was the principle of access that was vital to us. It's not that we thought that inside these presidential areas we were going to find weapons of mass destruction. And the Iraqis, of course, played this up and said, oh yeah, you're right, we have chemical weapons in, under Saddam, bet. That's where he hides these things. This was an issue which I think was a problem in Washington, particularly after a public debate or presentation which Albright, Cohen, and Sandy Berger had at Ohio State University, where they just got shredded and looked pathetic. And after that, I think they decided, and I have no particular knowledge of it, but it appeared that they were perhaps more interested in a resolution of this and were perhaps more willing to accept I say they, I can be careful here because, you know, the cabinet officers had different views, or perhaps the White House, but they were more interested in a negotiated settlement, perhaps, and were perhaps more willing to have Kofi go out there. I don't know what conversations took place between the president and Kofi. But, you know, the earlier reluctance on the part of the United States to have Kofi step into this, I think, attenuated a bit after that. But in any case, he went out there with a set of guidelines. There were some guidelines which the council had agreed to. There was a separate set of guidelines that the United States had provided to him. And he, you know, negotiated something with them, which, you know, deeply affected UNSCOM and the council's goals and objectives with Iraq. When he came back and briefed the council, I was present, and I was just really shaken by it. I mean, when he briefed the council, it was informal meeting, but packed. And really, you know, he briefed in a way that UNSCOM was the enemy. He used the word cowboys. And I had, I gave a lot of thought to resigning at that point. Had written a letter, ultimately did not. Some pressure was put on me, but there was a lot of dismay in UNSCOM.
And UNSCOM had not had a role in briefing the Secretary General or in preparing him? Or
we had a limited role. I mean, he asked for Butler to come up and brief him about, well, what exactly are these presidential areas and, you know, what's important about them. There was a lot of noise in the system. The Iraqis were saying, you know, they were unclear on what they meant by the presidential areas. We briefed the SG and his staff on what we believed to be the issues, and that we believed this by empirical experience, because, you know, we knew we had been blocked, and so we kind of, you know, we indicated to him what our judgment was that they were concerned about. And the Iraqis then came up with their own set of definitions, and the first step, in fact, that the Secretary General took was to request a survey mission go out, which was unaffiliated with UNSCOM, and he asked the Austrian government to provide some people under the leadership of a fellow named Stefan Mistura, who had served out in Baghdad, as a Swede who was known to the Secretary General. He went out there with some of these surveyors. He took along a French member of UNSCOM who was a bit familiar with him because he served as one of our photo interpreters. But he was, you know, most definitely not an UNSCOM person and was prohibited from talking to UNSCOM. They conducted a survey and came up with it was very quickly done, but, you know, they did what they thought was required of presidential areas. And this was the first step which the Secretary General took, again, moving UNSCOM out of the picture. Events were not solved.
I want to move back to something that you were talking about, and that is the so-called mechanism. Scott Ritter, in his various writings, gives, or at least in interviews, gives a lot of attention to this, and connects it to a certain extent with assistance that the Israelis provided, because they were, in his words, very good at this type of identification of moving sites. What can you say about this mechanism? Did this really become a principal target for UNSCOM? And equally important,
if this was the target, then the actual discovery of weapons or weapons capacity, how was that related to discovering the mechanism?
I think let me address the second part first, which is sort of the principle of why this focus on concealment, and then I'll return to the Israeli angle, because the Israeli angle precedes this. As I said, the summer of 95 was really an inflection point for UNSCOM, and I think Rolf Acaeus. Many of us had the view that Iraq was cheating. I think all the experts did. So, I mean, when I say the experts, there was sort of a core. People floated in and out of UNSCOM, but there was some long-term, you know, recidivists in this endeavor. But when Hussein Kamel defected and we analyzed the documents which were provided, you know, we were embarrassed by what we had missed. I mean, there were ongoing activities going on that we had not seen. Shortly afterward, in November of 1995, we became aware of, and the Jordanians intercepted, based on information we provided to them, an attempt to bring long-range ballistic missile, submarine launched ballistic missile guidance systems into Iraq. So this, you know, further galvanized the commission that things are going on here. So Acaeus agreed that we ought to have a dedicated effort to penetrate this concealment activity and mechanism. And the rationale for it was twofold. One was to try to catch them. They'd say, well, if you've got a Scud, let's find it. But, you know, we weren't that stupid to think that, well, if we actually get to a warehouse where there's a Scud inside, the Iraqis would say, oh, well, yeah, you're right, this is the warehouse, might as well come in and see it. Now, we would get blocked. And you know, so the Iraq could preserve this sort of last shred of ambiguity. But we thought, you know, with some clever array of techniques and collection methods, we might be able to catch them, and perhaps catch them in a way that we could demonstrate to the council that they were retaining prohibited materials. And
but catch them in concealment, right?
Yes, but you know, I mean, yes. But here again, I want to return to the theme that, you know, we, the commission, were feeling pressure from the council to prove to them that Iraq wasn't complying. And Acaeus was feeling that pressure. You know, go back, and you know, the French were saying, you should be briefing us regularly. We need to get on with business. You know, these are big stakes here. That, you know, these are contracts which are going by the wayside. There's a lot of money on the line. Russians, Primakov made clear to Acaeus that, look, they owe us $8 billion. That's why we won.
He was that direct.
In February of 90, Acaeus was in Moscow in February of 96 and in 97. And I believe it was in 96 where, it might have been Ivanov. It might have been Ivanov, who was Deputy Prime Minister, or Deputy Foreign Minister at the time, who said flat out, listen, they owe us $8 billion. You know, we've got to move forward here. But then, yes, they were that explicit. I mean, they would say the usual things about, no, the council has got to fulfill its mandate, and blah, 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 and the Iraqis. But they said $8 billion is real money. And, yeah, Russians, they've got a lot of problems, particularly at that time. So the second, you know, rationale was that, well, look, you know, we recognize the Iraqis may not let us in, but we're going to make ourselves so annoying to them that they'll stop. So make them stop. And if we keep raising it, so if they really want to get the oil embargo lifted and sanctions relax, to remove. They've got to stop us. And we're just going to keep at it. And we're just causing so much pain. They say, look, you know, it's not worth it. You know, let's give it up. So I figured that, you know, there's these two things. Now, in a way, maybe we were falling into a trap in the sense that maybe we should have just told the Security Council and said, look, you know, you set us up. We were created to verify Iraq's declarations to us. The burden of proof was on Iraq. You've got to figure out how to get Iraq to do that. We're sitting here, we're telling you what they're telling us is wrong. It's not verifiable, it's wrong. You know, and maybe we should not, we perhaps, you know, we're falling into a trap in the sense that we were letting the Security Council off the hook. And, you know, if there's one thing the council likes to do, it's like they don't want to be, you know, responsible for anything. They'll maneuver and dodge and whatever. So, you know, in retrospect, you know, I think, you know, one could, you know, debate that question. But in any case, that's what we wanted to do. And we had a lot of creative and energetic people. We had gathered some information on what we believe the concealment practices were, and you know, the center of this was Nikita Smirnovich initially. Mm-hmm. Scott Ritter has become famous for this in a way, but the real initiative beginning early on was Smirnovich, and I strongly support them in making this case to Rolf. But the thinking began, the steps, initial steps were taken in the fall of 95. And the first inspection, which took place in March, UNSCOM 143, had in fact been initially planned for November of 95. But some of the things which we had hoped to do, we were depending upon the United States to provide assistance on, and we felt that we were getting a bit of a rope-a-dope from the United States. You know, they were saying they were going to do one thing, and they, you know, they didn't produce it. So we, over Thanksgiving weekend, had some conversations. I talked with Rolf, in fact, a little bit, I remember I was on Stratton's skiing in Vermont. Said, look, these guys are diddling this. Let's cancel it. And Rolf was a little bit reluctant at that point because, you know, he'd been talking to Tony Lake and others. Mm-hmm. We got to communicate here. One way to communicate here is to just cancel it. Mm-hmm. And we did. And that had a bit of a galvanizing effect on the supporting elements of the U.S. government. And I can discuss that further, but you had also asked about the Israeli connection. The Israeli, well, UNSCOM, I mean, we were a bit of a carnivores when it came to information. We wanted anything we could find out that would help us, we were interested in, whether it was on the internet, newspaper articles, we were interested. And we'd take information from anybody. It dawned on us that, you know, one actor in the region who might know something about Iraq would be the Israelis. And what could they tell us? There was some, you know, there were early communications with them. You know, I knew some of them. Tim Turan, who was Nikias's kind of an executive assistant at the time, was at a meeting where there were Israelis present and floated an idea, and there was some dialogue. In various ways, but it ultimately came to pass that it was agreed that there would be a meeting in New York in March of 94, an initial meeting at the Tudor Hotel, I remember, and which is now called the Crown Plaza. In any case, it's this, you know, small hotel near the UN on 42nd Street. And it was agreed that the Israelis had experts who had been following these matters in Iraq. They certainly have been analyzing the Scud missile program because they've been they've received a few of these, and they could provide us with some information. And so we agreed to a program of visits where the Israelis would, their experts would sit down with our experts and discuss a given topic. And this was useful. But it also became apparent that they had information about how the Iraqi government was structured in some way that we had not, as an objective at that point in time, been collecting information on how the security organs worked, what they did, who were the key figures and so forth. And that gave us a little bit of a start in developing a model. A model which, Scott Ritter did some very creative and energetic analysis on this, and it was a model that we, built a lot on, and I think ultimately we knew much more than anybody else in the world other than the Iraqis about how they operated. But it was our analytical approach was to build a hypothesis, in a sense, trying to weave together the facts that we had, connect the dots together as in a way that we felt reflected reality, and then test that through various inspections and so forth, and came over time that I think we did pretty well. But this began in the fall of '95 under the leadership of Nikita Smidovich. It was a very closely held analytical and inspection activity. We looked at right until we left Iraq in various ways.
What were the other most important sources of information? Our intelligence in the United States presumably was the most important for the whole operation.
Well, you got to be careful on what you mean by. I mean, there's information and there's material support. Frankly, the United States was vital to begin with. Alpha Caius gets called up in Vienna and says, I want you to come and, head something that we've called UNSCOM. Well, good grief, no one knew what they were doing at that point. And, he started, gluing this thing together. But, what are you going to do? You're supposed to go into Iraq and make sure there aren't any weapons. Well, I don't think Rolf knew a lot about Iraq. He got there. We didn't have maps. So the United States was in a position where they provided maps, they provided some information, briefings, they provided the U-2 and all these sorts of things, which is vital to begin with. But over time, the United States wasn't in Iraq. We were. And we gradually learned an awful lot more about what was going on in Iraq than they knew. But they still provided a lot of support, technical support, imagery support, and that was very, very important. Setting up the monitoring system, the chemical labs, all this stuff, they were very, very helpful on. And in a way, it was a bit contradictory, because if you assume that they were not interested in UNSCOM reporting under paragraph 22, that we had done what we need to do, and now the council could take steps on lifting the oil embargo in the oil embargo days, one could look at what the United States is doing and saying, well, it's kind of against their interest. Why should they be so helpful? And this was, again, a point which Rolf used in discussing, with the Iraqis why they should cooperate, in fact, with other members of the council, with the U.S. was doing. But, there was a gradual shift over time about what UNSCOM knew and what the United States knew and was able to tell UNSCOM. I would say by 1995, when we had come into possession of a lot of these documents, that we were way ahead of the United States and any other government, frankly, in overall knowledge of what was going on in Iraq. Now, that's not to say that countries wouldn't receive pieces of information from various sources that would we would be unaware of and would be useful to us. But the United States didn't, for the most part, have a lot. There was always a suspicion. The Iraqis were quite funny on this. There was a suspicion the United States knew much more. And, you know, part of that was just, you know, behavior on UNSCOM's part, where we didn't focus on some issues. I mean, the Iraqis had to be wondering, in 1991 through 1994, why aren't they asking us about biological weapons? And the assumption that the Iraqis had, they told me this, is that the United States was holding back on that because they wanted prolonged sanctions and the embargo as long as possible. Therefore, they wanted it. I mean, there was these kinds of things. But in 1995, 96, we got limited information from the United States. We got useful information from Israel. We got some limited information from Russia when we pressed them, and that was largely with respect to the Scud missiles. They provided us good information on what they had shipped in the Scud missile area to Iraq. Mm-hmm. Curiously, they also provided that to the Iraqis when we had a period of time in the fall of early winter of 96 where we were going to focus on getting to the bottom of the missile issue with Iraq. And this was an initiative that the KS had with Tariq Aziz, and the Russians were supporting us in this. But we also found that the Russians had had some of the key Iraqi figures, Amir Rashid, Hussam Amin, and others, invited them to Moscow to discuss all their details of their accounting. And we had asked the Russians, could you tell us, could you told the Iraqis? But, you know, I'm trying to, you know, giving the Russians some credit for helping us out in some of these things. They didn't help in other areas. We had chronic problems with some other suppliers, members of the Security Council. We kind of made it a point not to discuss publicly suppliers. I know I mentioned a little bit about Russia, that's kind of out there now. But there were some members of the council who flat out refused to ever answer any questions on what they had provided to Iraq, even though the Iraqis would tell us what we were never quite sure about was all. And, you know, of course, they would still complain to us in the council meetings that we hadn't, you know, we weren't proceeding fast enough. So there's, I mean, there's different kinds of information. There's supplier information, there's information which may come to some countries' attention about ongoing activities through cutout companies and so forth. It was a personal project of mine to develop access to Iraqis who had left Iraq. I tend to prefer not to use the word defector, because defector means they've moved, they've shifted loyalty to another country, but a lot of people, they're moving for various reasons. But in any case, there's a lot of Iraqis who've left. Oddly enough, many of them have a lot of knowledge. And the first time we were able to make use, we were able to do this was when, and it's a known case now, Wafriq Samurai, who had been held as military intelligence during the Iran-Iraq War, left. He went to, initially to northern Iraq, and was hanging out in the area of Sulaymaniyah. It became known that he was out, and I explored through Washington contacts that, look, I'd like to talk to this guy. I think UNSCOM should talk to him. You know, we know things and we can ask questions that, you know, secondhand isn't going to happen. And after a lot of my haranguing, I got some support from the United States to get access to this guy. And myself and Tim Trevann and Nikita Sminovich made our way to northern Iraq and spent some very, very productive hours with this guy. This was in February of 1995, and he told us some things about his direct and indirect knowledge of what Iraq retained. This gave us reason to believe that there were many things that Iraq hadn't told us, particularly in VX. Again, this goes back to some of my problems with us giving Iraq a fairly positive report in June, connected to the deal with Tariq Aziz. But he said a fair amount about the chemical and biology and also in the missile area. But in a more important sense, he gave us an idea of what documents would exist. And he was not in a position to directly observe some things, but he was in a position to directly observe the types of documents which were created, particularly immediately after the war, summarizing Iraq's remaining holdings in various areas. But this experience became very useful and caused me to try to look for other opportunities. And obviously, Hussein Kamel was one.
Could I just interrupt there? What about Hussein Kamel? Was your access adequate? Was did